The headlines. Nigerians are heading to the polls to choose a successor to President Muhammadu Buhari. Voters cast ballots in parliamentary elections as well. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says it has developed a new long-range cruise missile. And the death toll from the massive earthquake that struck Turkey and Syria on February the 6th surpasses 50,000. Welcome, everybody. Nigerians are heading to the polls to cast their ballots in presidential and parliamentary elections. The vote is seen as a litmus test for the ruling All Progressives Congress Party of incumbent President Muhammadu Buhari. More than 90 million people are registered to vote in Africa's most populous nation. The presidential race is highly unpredictable, as Buhari has faced huge challenges from terror attacks to a sluggish economy. During his eight-year tenure, the ruling party has fielded Bola Tinubu to replace Buhari. The opposition People's Democratic Party has chosen former Vice President Atiku Abubakar as its candidate, but a surprise third candidate is Labour Party's Peter Obi. The ballot counting is expected to take several days, but a runoff has been predicted. U.S., European and other governments have urged calm, but Nigerian elections have often been marred by violence due to political and ethnic tensions. Our correspondent Danjuma Abdullahi is once again joining us from the Nigerian capital, Abuja, to bring us up to speed on all the latest developments with regards to voting day in Nigeria. Danjuma, over to you.
All right. Well, thank you. Today is a very important day in the history of Nigerians, because it is the day that millions of Nigerians are casting their vote to vote for a president who will rule the country for the next 4 years, and also parliamentary elections, that is senators and members of the House of Representatives, who will, in the next 4 years, be in the Nigerian Parliament, which is called the National Assembly. According to the Independent National Electoral Commission of Nigeria, there are 87 registered voters that are up for grabs in these elections. There are four major candidates: Mr. Atiku Abubakar, who was once Vice President of the People Democratic Party. There is also Bola Ahmed Tinubu. He is the one that is trying to take over from Muhammadu Buhari, because he is from the All Progressives Congress (APC). Then there is Muhammad Konkoso, Rabiu Konkoso, a former defense minister in Nigeria. He is of the NNPP, and of course Peter Obi, who is a one-time governor of one of the southeastern states. He is the candidate for Labour Party. Voting accreditation started very early here in Abuja. I'm standing very close to a polling unit, a suit area, Abuja, and accreditation started very early in the morning. Materials were supplied. Many people were accredited. As a matter of fact, voting started in some places at around 9 o'clock Nigerian time. People have voted. Like in this polling unit, most people have voted. Other people are waiting to cast their vote. And so far, from telephone calls that I have made across the country, I have not received any breach of the peace. I have not received anything that will affect the polls. Everything seems to be going very smoothly. But it is very early in the morning right now in Nigeria. So maybe as we continue to monitor the trend of events later during the day, we will get a better picture of what it has been in other parts of the country. Because right here in the Federal Capital Territory, Abuja, the Nigerian capital, it is not one of the flashpoints where problems are expected. So everything seems to be going very well. monitor the situation across Nigeria, and I will continue to update you.
All right, thanks a lot, Danjuma. We'll be hearing from you later on in the day. That was our Nigerian correspondent, Danjuma Abdullahi, joining us from Abuja. Elsewhere, tens of thousands of Yemeni protesters came out in a mass rally to show support for Palestine and to condemn the assassination of Yemen's president, Salah al-Samad, back in 2017. Yusuf Mauri has the latest.
The streets of the Yemeni capital were poured with a huge number of Yemeni protesters who came out to express support for Yemen's late president, Salah al-Samad. Salah al-Samad was assassinated by the Saudi-led coalition back in 2018. He is hailed here as Yemen's martyred president.
We came out today to express solidarity and loyalty to the martyred president who sacrificed his life on the path of Allah. And we say to the killers of al-Samad, your criminal and reckless atrocities has given new life to a nation. The Yemeni people will accept nothing but the just punishment against the perpetrators.
Protesters also expressed solidarity with Palestinians who are suffering from Israeli regime attacks and crackdowns. Yemen's main cause is the Palestinian cause, according to government officials who addressed the crowd at the rally.
To the Palestinian people, we say, your blood is our blood, and our blood is your blood. Every drop of blood that is spilled in the land of Palestine is a drop of blood being spilled here in Yemen. Any oppression Palestinians face is considered oppression that is happening to us and every honorable Muslim.
The Palestinian cause will always remain dear and deep in the hearts and souls of the Yemeni people.
The latest protest in Sana'a comes in the midst of ongoing political efforts by the UN Special Envoy to Yemen to reach a deal between the Yemeni government and the Saudi-led coalition to end the conflict. Even if the war comes to an end, the Ansarullah-backed Yemeni government will continue to face many challenges from world powers, given its unequivocal support for Palestine.
Despite 8 years of war and a strangling blockade that has stirred Yemen into becoming the world's worst humanitarian crisis, tens of thousands of Yemenis remain defiant and showing support for the Palestinians who remain occupied by the Israeli regime. Yusuf Mawdi, Sana'a.
Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says it has developed a new cruise missile with a range of over 1,600 kilometers. The commander of the IRGC's Aerospace Force says the missile is dubbed after the city of Pave to honor the martyrs of Kurdistan Province. Brigadier General Amir Ali Hajizadeh made the comment in an interview on the national broadcaster. He said Iran now possesses hypersonic missiles, which no air defense system may ever be able to intercept. The general said all missiles. Iran is now producing a precision strike weapons. The country has made quick advancements in its missile program in recent years. Tehran, however, has repeatedly stressed that its missile program is purely defensive and meant for deterrence. Well, joining us on this segment of the news review, we have political analyst Sayed Mostafa Khoshchesh, who's joining us from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Also, we have journalist, activist, and political analyst John Bosnich, who's joining us from Belgrade. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Khoshchesh in Tehran. I want to get your thoughts initially on this recent news by the IRGC about a new cruise missile with a range of over 1,600 kilometers. Talk to us about the significance of this new advancement.
Hello, Barry, and thanks for having me. Well, it's no secret that Iran has made much advancement in the area of technology, especially missile industries and drone technology and some other military technologies. Some of the features of the Iranian missiles have never been developed before. They are unique, including the precision striking capability that you just mentioned. Almost most ballistic missiles and other types that have been developed, especially ballistic missiles, by other countries, they are not so much precise because they are not meant to actually carry conventional warheads. But because Iran is not looking for a WMD or a nuclear warhead, It's been trying to, give this kind of capability to its missiles, especially ballistic missiles, to have a very precision capability. Sometimes they strike the targets in a range, within a range of half a meter, that's 50 centimeters, for a ballistic missile that travels for 2,000 kilometers. The same is true about Iran's cruise missiles. Iran has also been developing different types of cruise missiles in order to be equipped with both sides. Now, what matters more is with regard to the hypersonic missile that you just mentioned. Maybe I'll refer to that, in the second part.
All right, let's cross over to John Bosnich in Belgrade. Mr. Bosnich, give us your thoughts on the significance of this recent advancement that has been unveiled by the IRGC, and looking at the issue of self-sufficiency as to almost all of Iran's defensive equipment and capabilities are indigenously built. Many believe that the issue of sanctions has also contributed to the issue of self-sufficiency of the Islamic Republic.
Well, obviously, sanctions are in themselves a step towards war. They're a violation of international trade agreements, and they are the way that the United States and Great Britain generally soften up their victims before attacking them. So once sanctions are applied against your country, you can generally assume that there's more coming down the pipeline in terms of bad news. And the military encroachment around Iran with the American fleet and with British soldiers has shown clearly that Iran has to be prepared to protect itself, just like any other country. The relatively short range of the hypersonic weapon that we are talking about today means that it is a regional defense mechanism and not a worldwide strike mechanism. It also indicates, especially with the precision targeting, that it is intended to hit command and control centers, which would be commanding and controlling an aggressive military attack on Iran. So in each case, Iran has the right as a sovereign state to defend itself, and it also has the right to prepare itself for what are very obvious saber-rattling moves from the Anglo-American military complex.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Political analyst Said Mostafa Khoshchesh joining us from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Also, journalist, activist, and political analyst John Bosnich speaking to us from Belgrade. And with that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review. Welcome back. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has called on the Palestinian people to step up their resistance against Israeli regime and settlers. Hamas reiterated that Israeli crimes will not change the identity of the Arab land as well as Islamic and Christian sanctities. The resistance movement made the call in a statement marking the 29th anniversary of the massacre of Palestinians by an American Israeli extremist group at the Ibrahimi Mosque in the occupied West Bank city of Al-Khalil. In the statement, Hamas said the anniversary of this heinous crime has coincided with yet another massacre in Nablus. There, at least 11 Palestinians were killed in an Israeli raid on Wednesday. Hamas said the Nablus deadly raid once again revealed the fascist nature of the Israeli regime. And a British court has ruled that a London-based company is liable for a deadly blast that hit the Lebanese capital, Beirut, more than 2 years ago. The judgment by the High Court of Justice in London was issued after a lawsuit was filed against the British firm Savaro. There will be a further hearing to determine damages. The lawsuit was filed by lawyers from the Beirut Bar Association as well as families of some of the victims. They say Savaro is responsible for improper storage of chemicals at a Beirut port warehouse. There, hundreds of tons of ammonium nitrate had been stored, which detonated and caused a huge blast. Back in August 2020, the incident left over 200 people dead. The latest ruling by the London court is regarded as an important step towards justice, as investigations into the incident have been impeded. The death toll from the landslides and floods that hit Brazil's southeast last week has risen to 57. Only one of the deaths has been reported outside the city of São Sebastião. Rescue operations are still underway in the affected areas in the state of São Paulo as dozens remain missing. According to local officials, more than 4,000 people have been forced to leave their homes. Tourists have also been urged to refrain from traveling to the cities in the region as more rainfall is expected. Brazil has been hit by a series of disasters triggered by extreme weather conditions in recent years. Flooding killed hundreds in the country last year. The death toll from the earthquake that hit Turkey and Syria earlier this month now tops 50,000. Turkish authorities have confirmed more than 44,000 fatalities as more bodies are pulled from under the rubble. Syria early raised the number of deaths from the magnitude 7.8 earthquake to nearly 6,000. The February 6th tremor completely destroyed or severely damaged more than 160,000 buildings in Turkey. According to official figures, it has also displaced 1.5 million people. And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
With you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution during a meeting with a number of elegists, eulogists, and religious poets in the Imam Khomeini Husseiniya on January 12, 2023. The meeting took place one day before the anniversary of the birth of Lady Fatima Zahra Salamullah Aliha. We must not underestimate the enemy. The enemy exists. The day when you become so strong that the enemy loses all hope will be the day when you can feel tranquil and find peace of mind. We must work to make ourselves stronger. My emphasis, repeating and insisting that the country should become strong, is because of this. We must make the enemy lose hope. Thank God, with his spirituality, with God's help, and with his guidance, the nation is serving the revolution. It is behind the revolution, and the government and the people are helping. We have good elements. We have very productive, useful institutions. The effects of revolution are becoming more apparent outside the country's borders every day as well.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Another point that I wanted to mention, which I have just remembered, is about combining elegies with anthems. This has recently become a common practice, and this is very good. Some great songs have been sung. For example, the song Salam Farmande was a good song. You saw how this song was translated and sung again in other places. In some countries, of course, this was not reported in the news, but I was informed about this. They repeated the same thing that the children had sung here. They repeated their song in their countries in the original Farsi language, even though they did not know Farsi. They sang the original version. These are factors that can aid in increasing the authority of the country. Of course, when you enter this field, and all of you are thankfully active in this field, a number of people will show their admiration, but some will become your enemies. The arrogant powers will become your enemy, and the agents of the arrogant powers will become your enemy. They will disrupt your work and act against you. Well, let them. This enmity is something that will always be there. That which will prove what you're made of and will show your final outcome is your perseverance, steadfastness, and trust in God. It is said in a poem, "My rivals seek support from each other after killing me. But, oh, heartwarming love, I seek support from you." Well, it is noon or prayer time now. God willing, Allah will help all of you to be successful. I will definitely pray for all of you. Please pray for me as well. O Lord, by Muhammad and the progeny of Muhammad, peace be upon him, I ask you to bestow your blessings on all of us and on this nation, and by the blessed name of Lady Fatima Zahra Salaamu Alaiha. May God's greetings, mercy, and blessings be upon you. Assalamu alaikum.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Russian influence is growing in Africa. From West Africa in countries such as Mali and Burkina Faso to South Africa, the continent's most advanced economy. Western propaganda to isolate Russia has failed miserably. A demonstrator in the Central African Republic, a former French colony, says Russia has played a positive role in his country.
We recognize a friend in suffering. When we were in crisis, it was Russia that came to our rescue to liberate the country. We saw France, which was there but did nothing, and France continues to bully us. We have to tell certain truths today. Russia is coming to liberate us. Now we are free and we must support Russia at all costs until our last breath. Russia came to our country in the moment of crisis. Our country has suffered. Our country has been mistreated by the rebels. And that is why we came to support Russia.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of news and events making headlines in Africa. Today we are focusing on the unfolding Cold War in Africa between Russia and Western powers. African countries are meanwhile reasserting their independence while rejecting Western imperialism and neocolonialism. We are asking, will African countries succeed in their move to stop Western powers intent on meddling and countering Russia in the continent? The second part of our show today will be on continuing exploitation of Western and Central African countries by France through the CFA franc currency. Our experts today will give us their incisive analysis on these two subjects, and you can be part of the conversation by sending us your comments through our social media handle.
Russia-West new Cold War in Africa. Russia has been making diplomatic inroads in African countries that were seen as backyards of Western neocolonial powers, especially France. The US-led NATO military alliance has been angered by Russia's increasing influence in Africa, particularly at this time that the alliance is indirectly engaged in a military conflict with Russia in Ukraine.
Most African countries have refused to back NATO in its conflict with Russia. In fact, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa has blamed NATO for the war in Ukraine.
The war could have been avoided if NATO had heeded the warnings from amongst its own leaders and officials over the years that its eastward expansion would lead to greater, not less, instability in the region.
Well, to discuss increasing neo-Cold War rivalry between Russia and NATO in Africa, we have contacted Nefta Freeman, a coordinating committee member of the Black Alliance for Peace. Thanks for your time today. Now, over the recent months, we have seen a flurry of diplomatic activity with top-ranking US and Russian officials visiting Africa while Germany unveiled a new strategy for Africa. Now, are we witnessing a new Cold War in Africa amid the NATO-Russia conflict in Ukraine?
Yes, the heightened engagement with Africa is unquestionably a part of a new Cold War by the West, led by the United States. It has been waging a Cold War against Russia and China in particular. And so this is playing out in Africa as a new scramble for Africa. Africa remains central to the global markets, supply of raw materials, and has become also a place of exporting finished goods to. But over the last decade, the competition has been increasingly militarized, notably with the U.S.-NATO destruction of Libya in 2011, and turning Africa into really pretty much a hotbed of violent and extremist activity, giving the U.S. and other Western countries, France and whatnot, this pretext to say, well, they have to help African countries with militarization, AFRICOM, U.S. AFRICOM Command, and the French Foreign Legion, and these to come and stop the violent extremism that in fact, the U.S. is responsible, NATO is responsible for.
Uganda President Yoweri Museveni hosted Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and said he saw no reason to criticize Russia over its military operation in Ukraine. Museveni said Russia has a long history of backing African liberation when the continent was colonized by Western colonial powers.
The Africans started organizing, led by new forces. And the first group was in South Africa in 1912 when the African National Congress was founded. That was the modern African anti-colonial resistance movement. Fortunately, and that's how Russia comes in 1917, a new force took over Russia. These were the Bolsheviks. I don't know what problems you have with the Bolsheviks, whether you like them or you don't, but for us, we appreciate them because they supported us. They started supporting our anti-colonial struggle, and that is our relationship with Russia. Russia, so the Soviet Union supporting the anti-colonial movement in Africa.
Russian foreign minister visited Africa in February, and this was his third visit to the continent after the start of Moscow's special military operation in Ukraine. Analysts believe that Western powers are using strong arm tactics to counter Russia in Africa.
It appears that Russia is succeeding, and I think that has more to do with the insistence of the United States and the Western country, but particularly the United States, of using like strong arm tactics. That's traditionally what it does. That's also what characterizes neo-colonialism, using sanctions, using the international monetary, and the sanctions are actually exercised through the financial institutions. A lot of them are exercised also by the IMF and the World Bank and whatnot. And so they insist on not respecting the sovereignty of African countries. African countries should be able to do have their own relationships with whoever they so choose, but the U.S. wants to dictate that. And so when Sergey Lavrov comes, and they actually are coming after the on the heels pretty much in December of in December, the U.S. Africa's leaders summit that happened in Washington D.C. in December did not have the expected results that the U.S. wanted. Them trying to kind of court African leaders to take their sides in the world in this global competition for things. So the U.S. is becoming more overt in their strong arm policy.
Addressing the media after meeting his Eritrean counterpart Osman Saleh in February, Lavrov said Russia favors the principle of African solutions to African problems.
We had a detailed discussion of the African agenda. We have pointed out the need to normalize the situation in the conflict hotspots of Africa. We paid special attention to the situation in the African Horn region. We, together with our Eritrean friends, believe that in order to overcome the regional crisis, we require the promotion of a comprehensive approach through coordinated actions of the African states themselves, with the support from the international community. We have confirmed that Russia, including in its status as a permanent member of the UN Security Council, will continue making its contribution to strengthening security and stability in the African continent, based upon the well-known principle, African solutions for African problems. We shall not impose any external solutions to the Africans, and we see numerous attempts of doing that.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov also said that Western media outlets have been distorting facts while covering his tour across sub-Saharan Africa. Now, what's your take on this statement by Lavrov?
Well, they have to distort facts. The U.S., I think the U.S. and the leadership, the ruling class of the United States, because it's not regular people, believe their own perceptions about the world. This comes from a colonial mindset. But also at the same time, they have to sidestep the hypocrisy that they practice, the double standards they practice. One of the things, and I can remember this one distortion of facts, which is really an odd one, is to say, Russia and Lavrov are only visiting countries where there's rich mineral resources in Africa. This doesn't really make any sense to anyone who understands Africa. Every place in Africa is rich in mineral resources. It's not really a place you can go that you're not going to be able to, to have some go to some place that doesn't have rich mineral resources.
South African Defense and Military Veterans Minister Thandi Medise has hit out against the United States for trying to bully African countries from doing business with Russia. Medise said the Countering Malign Russian Activities in Africa Act, which seeks to sanction any African businesses or people doing business with Russia, should be rejected by African countries. More African countries are expected to defy the West.
I think we will see more, and we have seen more of the West. And a lot of it was when I mentioned earlier, the U.S., U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit, where they invited a lot of these leaders to Washington, D.C. Some of those deliberations, the African country were talking about how the U.S. is not really respecting the self-determination. I don't know if they use the word self-determination, but the rights of African countries to do business how they see fit, and that it was much along the lines of strong-arming and what we call, in the Black Lives Matter piece, we refer to it as gangsterism because that's what it is. But you're seeing a lot of what the African countries are more likely to defy it because the other forces, China, Russia, even whoever you can name, other forces beside the U.S. and besides the Western NATO countries, and people can talk about what their interests are, what their real interests are or not, but they come with a different, they come differently. Their bilateral relationships, their agreements. The U.S. is a gangster, and then NATO, they're gangster countries. We refer to that meaning they impose their will.
A tweet by the German Foreign Ministry in which it used a leopard emoji in referring to the Russian Foreign Minister's visit to Africa has created uproar in Africa after it appeared offensive to some. Now, Can such a tweet be indicative of Germany's colonial stereotypical view on Africa?
It certainly can be indicative of it. I don't know what was in their mind. I mean, Germany and the Western countries, they come out of a legacy of colonization and a dehumanization of Africa. They do not respect African, you know, African culture, African anything. And they even can't even take responsibility for the underdeveloped state that Africa is in terms of where there's poverty and these kind of things. They don't take responsibility for that. And it's directly at the shoulders of Europe and the U.S. Neocolonialism former colonialism or formal colonialism, as described by, if we could look at like the seminal work of scholars like Walter Rodney and the work, the book of How Europe Underdeveloped Africa, and even the works of like Kwame Nkrumah talking about neocolonialism and outlining the effects of neocolonialism.
South African Foreign Minister Naledi Pandor defended the decision during a joint media briefing alongside her visiting Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov, who is in the country for bilateral talks.
All countries conduct military exercises with friends worldwide, so there should be no compulsion on any country that it should conduct them with any other partner. It's part of a natural course of relations between countries. So I think we need to explain this to the public.
Now, what message is this military drill sending to Western countries?
These joint military operations in the U.S. has embarked on this, you know, this militarization of the continent through the U.S. Africa Command, AFRICOM. It's since 2008, maybe starting in 2007, where it has all of this, you know, military bases around, and the rhetoric around rhetoric or even its maneuvers around countering China, and then the legislation countering Russia. This sends the message to the West, these new developments with the naval drills, is that we don't consider you the hegemon anymore, or even the right to be the hegemon, and that we're not going to take sides also in the war between these forces.
Very well put there. Africa is reasserting its independence, and the joint naval drills by the South African Navy with Russia and China are a pointer to these new realignment of power in Africa. We now take a short break before our next topic on the CFA franc.
CFA franc, French colonial tax in Africa. You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
The CFA, which stood for French Colonies in Africa in 1945, now stands for Africa Financial Community. It is used in 14 African countries with a combined population of about 150 million and $235 billion USD of gross domestic product.
The CFA franc limits monetary sovereignty. France guarantees the value of the CFA franc, and in return, the countries that use it are required to at least 50% of their foreign exchange reserves with the French Treasury. Because the exchange rate between the CFA franc and euro is fixed, the central banks of the two CFA franc zones need to follow the monetary policies of the European Central Bank in order to maintain the peg. In other words, the European Central Bank effectively sets interest rates for countries that use the CFA franc.
The CFA franc is seen as a clear example of how France pursues a deliberate policy of continuing to plunder the countries it once colonized. Dr. Arikana Chihombori-Kwao, a former African Union ambassador to the U.S., weighs in here on how the CFA franc has disadvantaged African countries.
France is taking out of Africa, Francophone Africa, over $500 billion. Over $500 billion. We, the Africans, the poor countries, we're giving France over $500 billion a year. Year in, year out. And no one is talking about it. The latest figures are saying for every $14 billion that France takes out of Africa, by the time they finish investing it, they're realizing upwards of $300 billion for every $14 billion. So in actuality, France is taking out of Africa trillions of dollars year in, year out.
Now for more on this continued exploitation of Africa by France, we have contacted Mustafa Traore, an academic and political commentator. Thanks for your time today. Now, the CFA franc is seen as a vestige of French colonialism in Africa and has been referred by many as a sort of colonial tax on African countries. So why is this currency still being used in parts of Central and Western Africa?
It is true that it is a colonial currency. And the reason why it is still used, it is because it is in the interest of France. And we know that each time you had an African leader willing to change the situation to go out of the France CFA, this politician was eliminated. So we understand that the mechanism of the France CFA was inherited from the time of the Nazi regime. It is the Nazi regime who first used it against the French government, against the French nation. And then after the Second World War, the French used the same system, the system that was used by the Nazi, against the Africans.
Former Burkina Faso president Thomas Sankara opposed the CFA system because he believed that it was part of the economic stagnation that country endured. CFA franc is indeed the source of economic backwardness of Western and Central African countries, especially considering the fact that those countries using this currency are some of the poorest in the world.
Now, many analysts believe that the CFA franc was meant to control the cost of access to raw materials from the colonies and enable Paris to maintain its grip on the economies of these African countries. Now, can you elaborate further on some of the advantages France gets in ensuring African countries continue using the CFA franc?
Yeah, they can buy, they decide. They decide on what on the prices, which means that if something is too expensive, you can say, okay, I'm going to devaluate your currency, and now this is what your money is worth. So, and the thing is that the African currency is printed in France. Can you imagine? So it is printed in France. So, which means that this is what I sometimes explain to some of my students, because I teach English economics, and I tell to my students that there's nothing that the French government cannot buy in these countries, because they have the printing machine. Once you have the printing machine, nothing exists on earth in these countries that the French government cannot buy.
French President Macron is trying to influence the renaming of the CFA franc to ECO after the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, decided that a new regional currency will take effect in 2027. Some ECOWAS members not using CFA franc have rejected French influence in the transition to a new currency. France is apparently sabotaging a strong and independent common African currency in West and Central Africa.
What is very surprising here is the fact that France wants to have its word on it. Okay, we are dealing with African countries. It's their currency. So it's not to the French president to say how they are going to name the new currency and what they are going to do. Okay, if the African decides, if the Africans decide to change the currency, to change the system, they are free to do it. But France wants to be part of it. And what the Africans are saying, that they do not want you to be part of it. And the first people or the first countries to oppose the participation of France in that new currency are the English-speaking countries, okay? Those who are not using the franc CFA. So that's very important. So we know that, and it's not me saying it, it was former President Jacques Chirac who once said it, without some African countries, France is nothing.
Demonstrators take to the streets regularly in several French-speaking African cities to reject the CFA currency, saying it prevents development and is keeping countries in poverty.
We must do all it takes to ensure that the CFA franc is abolished forever.
With the growing unpopularity of France in Africa and the younger generation's rejection of its presence, are we going to see more demands for the dumping of the CFA franc?
Yes, I think so. I think, yeah, this is what is very likely to happen. Many countries are trying to set free from, let's say, the chains of France. We saw it in Mali, in Burkina Faso, and Guinea. And I'm sure that is good. We will have more countries trying to reject the French influence. And they do it first militarily, and the next step is the currency. So for sure, that is the next step.
Well, there you have it. Many African countries are going to free themselves from the shackles of French neocolonialism. I'd like to thank our guest, Mustafa Traore, for his insight today. That brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. It's been great having you. Goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. We welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Atta, the host of this program. Shaykh Karimi is the guest speaker for today's discussion. Assalamu alaikum, Shaykh. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Okay, for today's discussion, we want to continue your, we can say, a program with the topic how the religion of Islam was spread across the world, that the early Islam, was it through the power of the sword, or no, it was the peace talks, or we can call it a kind of victory over other lands by the, conciliation with the other lands, or no, it was the power of oppression or something like that. We call it the colonization on that time. So, Shaykh, you talked about, the nature of the wars and the battles of Prophet Muhammad inside Arab Peninsula, and how he was peaceful in his talks with his enemies. And most of his wars were, maybe 90%, 99% of the wars were defensive and not the offensive ones. Now, do you believe that the path of spreading Islam across the world after the demise of Prophet Muhammad was a kind of deviated from the right path or not?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As you rightly mentioned in the first program, I refer to some points regarding the words of the Prophet, Prophet peace be upon him and his family. And I believe that not only 90% and 99%, all the words of the Prophet were defensive, although the Holy Prophet had the right for initiative war as well. I also shared some verses of the Quran talking about the fact that religion in and of itself cannot be forced. Mm-hmm. Religion is a matter of one's belief and heart. So you may attack some countries, you may force some people to convert, but you cannot, rule over their hearts and mind. So after some month, after some years, or deep in their heart, they will not accept your religion. This is the fact mentioned in some verses. I share two verses. Before answering your question, let me share another verse from chapter Hud, verse 28, which is talking about one of the other prophets of God. In this verse, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, قَالَ يَا قَوْمْ أَرَأَيْتُمْ إِن كُنْتُ عَلَى بَيِّنَةٍ مِّن رَبِّي وَآتَانِي رَحْمَةً مِّنْ عِنْدِهِ فَعُمِّيَتْ عَلَيْكُمْ أَنُلْزَمُكُمُوهَا وَأَنْتُمْ لَهَا كَارِهُمْ. He said, O my people, tell me, should I stand on a manifest proof from my Lord, and he has granted me his own mercy, though it should be invisible to you, shall we force it upon you while you are averse to it? So the verse is clear that when people, do not like a religion, they hate the religion, they averse the religion for any reason, then The Prophet cannot force it upon them. That is why, as we mentioned in the previous program, the Holy Prophet never forced any person, any tribe to convert to the religion of Islam. We know that at his time, many Jewish people lived inside the city of Medina and around the city of Medina.
Yes.
And, the same is true about Christians, but mainly the Jews. And all of them continued to live under the Islamic government of the Prophet, and none of them were forced to accept the religion of Islam. And that is the reason that they come to a peace treaty with the Prophet. Yes. Of course, later they themselves broke the treaties, and it led to the following events. So the Holy Prophet in the city of Medina, especially after the conquest of Mecca, he had all power to attack many tribes, many regions, other countries. But the Holy Prophet never did that. He never attacked a village, let alone, a country or a tribe, for example. Now, when it comes to the time after the demise of the Prophet, we know that before Imam Ali alayhi salam is chosen by the people as the fourth caliph, although he was the immediate successor of the Prophet, we have three caliphs. And yes, we cannot negate the fact that they attacked some countries, and including the Persia at that time. And maybe that is the main reason that some people consider the religion of Islam as the religion spread through sword and power. Now, first of all, I refer to this point that as Shia, we cannot and we do not justify the acts done by these three caliphs. And we believe that they had no right to attack any country. This is one point. Second of all, although the act was not true, but then there are misunderstandings, there are exaggerations about the nature of these wars, the number of the people killed, and so on and so forth. So this is, the fact that it was wrong shouldn't lead us to come to some, exaggerations and wrong information about these wars. In many cases, or in the majority of the cases, for example, in Persia, the Iranians welcomed the Muslim army. Now, I would like to bring some evidences which prove that Islam was spread through, not through power and sword, but rather the people wanted the religion of Islam. Mm-hmm.
Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir. Inshallah, inshallah,
inshallah, you'll find your way. Let's talk about Iranian people. Although the attack was wrong, but the point is that Iranians welcomed the religion of Islam, and they liked this religion, and they converted to the religion of Islam deep in their heart. What is the reason? First of all, we know that the Mongols, they invaded different parts of Iran and Persia in different periods. For example, between 1219 to 1256, they attacked Iran. 10 years later, again, they attacked they also attacked Persia and Iran, and they destroyed many cities, including Tus, Neishabur, and Qom, and so on and so forth. And finally, the famous Hulaku in 654 after Hijra, they attacked Iran and also Baghdad, and many massacres were done.
Yes.
The numbers are very astonishing. But now the point is that the Mongols invaded Iran. They captured the whole Iran at that time in three periods. But did it lead to Iranians accepting the religion of the Mongols? Not at all. And rather, gradually the Mongols converted to the religion of Islam.
Yes.
And they helped the religion of Islam spread in other parts of the world as well.
Especially Al-Tusi. The outstanding scientist had role, the owner of Maraghe Observatory.
Exactly.
You know?
Thank you for that. Yeah. So this is the point. Iranians were attacked by Muslims and were attacked by Mongols. Mm-hmm. But they didn't accept the religion of Mongols. Rather, Mongols converted to the religion of Islam. But the Iranians welcomed the Muslim army and accepted the religion of Islam. And this is very meaningful. Okay, after some years, the Arabs did not live in Iran anymore. The Iranians could, return back to their previous religion.
Yes.
Okay, but they never did that.
Okay.
Which means that they accepted the religion of Islam. The other point is that, the other evidence is that, nowadays we have, Indonesia, Malaysia, and many other countries in South Asia, in Southeast Asia, and so on and so forth. Or, for example, Caribbean islands.
Yes.
And there are many, many Muslims living in this part of the world. Indonesia is the most populated Muslim country. And, of course, all people agree that no Muslim has ever attacked these places.
Mm-hmm.
And now the question is that if Islam was spread through sword and power, so what is the reality about these parts? Malaysia, Indonesia, Caribbean islands, and so on and so forth. So this is another indication, another evidence which proves that this is a wrong understanding about the spread of the religion of Islam. And nowadays, in our time, in many Western countries, are Muslim countries attacking all these Western countries? So much so that many elite among the followers